history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, those stories are right there in your midst. And taking a little time to listen to them can really have an effect on your perspective. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, we end up learning things that we might not learn anywhere else. We're educated, we're also entertained, and often we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Yet another year is coming to an end, and I know it can become a little cliche, but it can also be quite helpful to take a look back over the year that was, to give thanks for the things we got to experience, and then look ahead with resolve, enthusiasm, and perhaps even a more informed viewpoint toward the future. With that in mind, in this final week of the year, I've been reflecting on all the amazing veterans we've had the privilege of meeting in 2018 throughout these United States. Some who are still with us, others who have passed on, some even within a week or two of sharing their stories here. That reality always underscores the urgency, at least in my mind, how important it is to capture some of these stories before it's too late. More and more people are doing that now, and we're all better for it. If we take a ladies first approach, I'm thankful for the perspective we picked up from a woman Marine in Las Vegas, a Rosie the Riveter in Utah, and a USO performer in Bakersfield this year. We got to hear from a couple sailors whose sunken ships were found this year in an effort spearheaded by the late Microsoft co-founder Paul Allen. Japanese American veterans, Chinese American veterans, Army, Navy, Coast Guard, Marines, Merchant Marines, Army Air Corps. We've heard so many different ways that more than 16 million Americans in uniform and millions more in civilian clothes banded together to ensure what FDR called in his first wartime speech, absolute victory. Today in this final program of 2018, we'll hear from four different men we met in four different states over the past calendar year, starting in LaGrange, Wyoming, with a lifelong cowboy who was just an 18-year-old from Kansas in February 1945. He was preparing to lead a team of over 300 pack mules over the Himalayas to resupply Merrill's Marauders. But John Sussex never got that opportunity because his Liberty ship was sunk by a German torpedo.
I was sleeping in a mule chute. I didn't sleep down in the hold like the rest of the men. I didn't like it down there. I made myself a bed out of an old army cot up in one of them mule chutes that we loaded the mules on. And they was things, the chutes that we could pick up with the cables and stuff and lift them off the dock and set them down on the boat. That's what I slept in. And when they torpedoed that ship, I rattled around in that mule chute like a rubber bowl.
Well, and you can laugh about that, but I'm just imagining that may have been a life-saving decision for you to sleep up there as opposed to down below. Were there guys in those sleeping quarters down below who were killed in that submarine attack?
Yes, there was. And I went ahead and got out of that mule chute, dressed completely, even put my shoes or boots on and everything. So when that boat sunk and we got on the life raft, I was completely dressed and even had my boots on. Never got those boots off for a week.
Well, how chaotic was that scene? Can you help us understand how quickly it was sinking or what was going on aboard that ship and the atmosphere around you as you're trying to figure out what just happened?
No, they torpedoed that ship in the middle and it broke in two. And then they torpedoed the number one hold and that front half of that ship broke off from the back half and sunk. And I remember seeing the back half float away. There was I think two men in the engine room on the back half that was still in that back half of that ship when it floated away. That's all I remember.
And did you get to this wooden raft right away, or did you have to scramble to figure out where it was?
No, we knew where it was. My buddy and I had that thing tied to where we got off of that ship, and we ended up with two of them tied together, and there were 17 of us on those two rafts when we finally floated away. And when we did, the back half of that ship was still floating out there in the ocean. I don't know how long it floated, but I think it finally sunk too. But there was two men in the engine room, they told me, that couldn't get out.
Did you lose guys that you had gotten to know, that you had trained with, that you were friends with?
Oh, yeah. We lost men, and we lost all of our mules and everything. We got out of there with the clothes we had on our back, and that's it.
So as you described it, the ship is hit in the middle, and then again in the front, two torpedoes hit this Liberty ship. So you've got probably guys without rafts trying to float in the water. You've got hundreds of mules in the water. And I don't want to compare the life of a mule to the life of a man, but I imagine that you had a bond with those mules if you'd been training with them and you were expected to pack them across the Himalayas. What was it like to see this devastation and realize there's nothing you can do to save men or to save those animals?
You don't worry about it. You just keep going with your own deal. The boys that worried about it is the ones that would get you killed because they couldn't think. They was afraid, and they couldn't help it. I don't remember being afraid. And I remember a mule trying to get on the raft with us, and I had to knock him off with a short tibufo that was floating by to keep him off. There wasn't room for him on the raft.
Yeah.
The mules, of course, didn't make it, and a lot of the men didn't make it.
Well, and that comes to mind, too. Were you able to help some other guys get to the raft or get them aboard? Did you see guys struggling that were trying to find something to float with?
Yeah, if anybody went by and they was needing some help, you can just reach out and help them, that's all.
And what time of day was it when this happened? You said you were asleep, but was this at night? Was it in the morning?
10:30 at night, and the moon come out about then, and that sub that sunk our boat come up about then when we finally got on those rafts, and it went around and out of sight. It went around where our ship was, what was left floating, because the back half of that ship broke in two, and the back half of it was floating. And that submarine come out of the water and come out and went around. And I saw it fire two shots. I saw two tracer bullets in the sky. And that's all the last time I ever saw it. I don't know where it went from there, but that was it.
So again, I'm just trying to imagine what this is like. You're out in the ocean. You're on a raft. It's dark out. You get a little moonlight. Was there fire anywhere on the ship or anything that gave some more light? Or was it hard to see? Could you tell what was out there?
No, you couldn't. It was dark. It was 10:30 at night.
Yeah.
And you couldn't see. I think the moon did. The clouds moved a little, and the moon did come out one time, I remember.
What did you see when you woke up that next morning?
Water. A lot of it. You couldn't see a horizon anywhere. The only thing you could see, as far as you could see, was water.
Was it, were the waves choppy? Was it a calm sea?
There were swells. And if you was in a trough, you'd look up and you could see the water up above you. Then that swell would move and you'd be on top of it and you could see the horizon all the way around. It was just that simple, you know. You couldn't see land anywhere.
You can't see land. You don't know where you are. You don't know if there are Japanese in the area. You don't know probably if any Americans know that you guys were even sunk, right?
I guess so. What you do is don't worry about it. Just do what you have to do to keep it going, that's all. After 5 days, a plane flew over and circled and found us. And when they left, they fired two shots. And 2 days later, a Coast Guard cutter come out of Australia and picked us up. Just that simple.
He made it sound that simple, but we can imagine it was anything but. That was John Sussex of Wyoming. You can catch that complete original interview at hometownheroesradio.com. He's a member of the Wyoming Cowboy Hall of Fame for what he did after World War II. And a couple of other vets we met this year went on to establish their own car museums. Not far from Mr. Sussex in Julesburg, Colorado, Lee Kaiser's old Ford garage and museum is a must-see attraction if you ever go cross-country on Interstate 80. And in Santa Fe Springs, California, we visited another auto museum that reflected the life's work of Phil Reed. Phil passed away just shy of 99, about 6 weeks after his interview aired here. A lifelong mechanic who could fix just about anything, he had already made a couple of crucial repairs aboard the Landing Craft Infantry, LCI 35, before delivering troops to Normandy on June 6, 1944.
At Sword Beach, we carried British commandos we had a lot of, I forget how many ships we had in the flotilla, but we gave the British 10 ships to put their commandos on. We landed at Sword Beach, so it's a funny thing that happened. Last 2 years ago, I was over in France, and we cut out a restaurant. My niece took me over there, and I seen this soldier coming down, and he had all these badges on. I told my niece, I said, I'm going to talk to that guy. So I got talking to him, and he says, you know, he says, the funny thing is, I was on an American ship. He said, I can't figure out how we got on an American ship. So I told him, I knew exactly how he got on there. I said, you may have been on my ship, but I don't know. There was 10 of us.
Uh-huh.
But he had all these badges, and he had his uniform on. But he landed at Sword Beach.
Which is exactly where you guys were dropping them off.
And, yeah.
You know, so much has been said about that day, and it's been called the longest day. But how long of a day was it for you? Where did it start?
Not very long. I'll tell you, we landed up on a beach, unloaded the troops, and our anchor cable got stuck in the propeller there, screw. And so we chopped it off and let it go. But then a British ship hit the same thing. British ships was the same as ours, only their conning towers was a little bit lower.
Mm-hmm.
We towed them back to New Haven, England.
I don't want to interrupt, Phil, but you're describing this, and it seems to me there were probably a few other things going on there.
Oh, there was a lot of things going on.
I mean, you must have been hearing things, seeing things.
Yeah.
Worried that you might be feeling things.
Yeah, that gun is still up there in France on the beach.
Mm-hmm.
That big, I don't know how many millimeters it is, but it's still up there because when I went there last year, and I went there and saw it, but they were shooting down at us, but for some reason or another, they never did hit us, and you don't know who they hit. Because everything is going on. And
were you up topside and seeing all this, or where were you while this was happening?
Yeah, I was on top because we pull the ramps out for the soldiers to go down. Had a little gasoline engine, one on port, one on starboard. Well, nobody could get them things going, and so I was up there getting them started.
What didn't you fix on that ship, Phil?
Huh?
What didn't you fix on that ship?
Fixed a lot of things on the engine room.
So, and I know this was your life and you lived it, and you may not think it's as big a deal as the rest of us, but on this day where world history changed, where so many guys paid with their lives on those beaches, you're right at that beach trying to let these British troops off so they can go fight for freedom, and they can't even get off because the door won't go down to let them off.
Yeah.
And you had to fix it.
Yeah.
So how'd you fix it?
I don't know. I just got it started. There's two of them, one on each side.
So it's like fixing a lawnmower or something?
Yeah, that's what they were, actually.
Uh-huh.
They pull the ramps out, and then when you hit the beach, you drop them down. You release them, and they drop down. But I told the captain, this was once before another invasion, though. Told the captain, don't let them down yet. It's too rough out there. He said, let them down. So I pull them out. And a wave hit him, and one of our guys was on the other end, standing on the ramp and holding the troops back, and hit that wave way out here and just flipped that ramp right over my head. And the kid was hanging onto it, and a couple of guys dove in and got him up on deck, gave him artificial respiration, and he came through.
Wow. That's a pretty dramatic scene to take
in. I can still see that guy going through the air, hanging onto that ramp. He didn't let go.
Obviously, you were cool and calm under pressure, having to fix this while there's gunfire going around and all this chaos.
Yeah.
But were you scared at all? Were you nervous?
No, you don't. It don't bother you. You know, you got a job to do, and you just got to do that job.
You know, there's so many ships there. The enemy has so many forces. But where you guys dropped these British troops off, how close was the enemy fire coming to you guys on the ship?
Just up on the hill.
And they were shooting at your ship?
Yeah. Well, not the ours, all of them. They were lined up.
Yeah. So you could have been hit.
Yeah.
Sure.
You're lucky you didn't get hit.
So you dropped those guys off, and that was the only trip you took that day?
No, we went back. Yeah, but we made 25 other trips.
I have to imagine that you saw things you'd never seen before.
Yeah. Yeah.
What was the hardest thing to see or realize or think about?
Well, the only thing that was really hard was when that ramp got thrown off. And you see that kid, you know, hanging on. I can still see him hanging on to that ramp. I don't know why he didn't let loose of it, but he hung on to it and went down with the ramp, but then he came back up. And
I'm sure you didn't have him on there for too long, but you ever think about those troops that you delivered to that beach and what might have happened to them?
Yeah, lots of times. I remember one of the beaches we landed, I think it was Salerno. What we did, as we went in to shore, we dropped the anchor just before we got there, and that would pull us back off, but the anchor didn't hold one time, and that was in Salerno. All these ships are lined up as far as you can see, LCLs and LSTs and unloading stuff. Our anchor didn't hold, so we turned around. Our bow was out towards sea, and the stern was towards the beach, and a duck came along and said, get your anchor, and we'll put it in our Jeep, and we'll take it out, and you can get another hole at it.
Did that work?
That poor duck, no. He just tore the back end of that duck completely off.
So what ended up happening to you guys on that LCI?
Oh, we got off. A tug came along and finally. But while we were there like that, couldn't believe it. But these all ships are all lined up as far as you can see. And here comes a German 109 strafing all these ships. We're the last one down here. And he was strafing all these ships. He, just before he got to us, pulled up. And as he pulled up, we shot him down.
Wow.
And we got credit for shooting down one German.
How about that? And I want to hear about the other landings you guys made, but I guess for people, again, who aren't familiar with an LCI, maybe you should tell us how big they were, big your crew was.
It was 158 feet long,
mm-hmm.
20 feet wide, flat bottom.
It's not very big.
No, 158, and we carried 200 troops. It was really loaded when you...
And something tells me it probably didn't handle rough seas all that comfortably.
Yeah. Another deal that happened, we were in Palermo, and we were hauling troops up to the Straits of Messina and going to let them off there. And it was 12 o'clock at night, and I just got off a watch. I just got back down to the cruise quarters, and heard a bang, and we hit a British cruiser broadside. They said if we would have been half a minute longer, he would have cut us right in half.
Wow.
And then on the way back, they pushed all our bow in, but nothing leaked. And so on the way back to Palermo, we were sitting alongside the ship there, and all of a sudden somebody hollered, there's a mine. And a mine went right by us within 2 feet. You could almost touch that. I could still see those things sticking up.
You could see it from where you were.
You were sitting there.
Wow.
I wouldn't be here today if we would have hit it.
Yeah, you got a couple kids who had never been born. There's a great family photo here on the wall, and I'm sure some of those folks wouldn't be here either.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Well, speaking of family, did you ever hear from your brother on that other LCI?
Oh, yeah. He got on that, and he ended up in Maryland someplace after the war. He had a lot of experience. A lot of things happened.
What kind of connection or bond did you form with the other guys on that LCI?
Oh, there's only 17 of us. It's not a big crew. You had just enough to make your changes, watches.
Uh-huh. So you guys must have been pretty close.
Oh, you were. Yeah, we were.
And you went through a lot together.
Yeah. Yeah, the last one that a good friend of mine that he's just chum around with all the time. He just died last year.
So you're telling me you're the last of your 13 siblings alive and the last of your 17-man crew alive?
Yeah, I'm the only one left.
And now he has left us as well. Phil Reed was a longtime supporter of the restoration of LCI 713 in Portland, Oregon, and even collected donations for that cause at his car museum. An incredible man who left an incredible legacy. It's time for our first break, but there's much more to come in this special year-end edition of Hometown Heroes. A visit to Nevada's capital city for a man who helped save his submarine, and then on to the Midwest for a carrier pilot who earned the Navy Cross. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHSmaster will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com. And tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, celebrating the things we learned, the stories we heard, and the amazing veterans we met in 2018 by revisiting excerpts from their experiences. In Carson City, Nevada, we met a 96-year-old submarine veteran named Del Schichtenberg. He was a licensed pilot before he even turned 16. He'd entered the Navy a year before the attack on Pearl Harbor, and he has long made sure that others remember the 52 submarines the U.S. lost in World War II with nearly 3,500 men aboard. He's also very thankful that his sub, the USS Sandlance, was not added to that list in the spring of 1944.
We were in the Sea of Okhotsk, which is right between the Sea of Japan and the Russian naval base. We had this convoy come through with two Japanese destroyers and two freighters, unmarked, no flags. We sank them. They were both Russian. But in making this attack, we also had icebergs that were floating along and hit the number one periscope, which was the attack scope, Bennett, and it could only go down a few inches. It was jammed, in other words. So the only thing we could do was cut out the upper bearing in order to get a bigger diameter to take care of some of that bend to keep the feather from that scope going over the other scope, rendering it useless.
Well, and I know this is old hat and obvious to you, but most people listening have never been on a submarine. They don't know how periscopes work. They don't know the impact of this. So can you spell out for us why that was such a severe problem to have that periscope bent?
Well, the periscope is the only connection you have with the outside world to know whether there's ships up there, where they're at, airplanes, whatever you can see. Airplanes usually came in with the sun, and you didn't see them anyhow.
Well, having that periscope bent put severe limitations on the operability of this sub and put all your lives in danger.
That is correct. With the bent one, it puts a feather of water up over the second one, which rendered it useless. So that was the reason we had to get the bent one down to where that feather of water would not go over the second periscope. We had two periscopes. In case one was out of commission, we had another one we could fall back on. One was an attack, which was a very small lens at the top. And the second one was a little stubbier, so there were two different kinds. One of them had radar on it, and the other one didn't. The attack didn't.
But so you guys have to stay on the surface while you try to fix this, right?
That is correct.
And that puts you in danger.
Yes, we had an air attack. We just barely got up on top of the periscope shears. This was when the skipper took it out 25 miles from the coast of Japan. My second class was an Indian, and he had a good eyesight, and he spotted this plane coming in from Japan, a Coast Guard patrol. So by the time we got down going through the conning tower hatch, that was the first radar contact we had with it, and that was 10 miles. Well, at the speed those Zeros flew, 10 miles don't take very long.
So you're up on top of the boat trying to fix this periscope, and there's a plane coming in, so you have to hustle down below and hope they don't hit you?
Yeah. And we were up about 45 feet above the waterline, and the lookouts were halfway in between.
So what happened when the plane came in?
He went past, came back in with the sun where he could see us. We were actually too close to him when he came over the first time. So he turned around and came in with the sun, and they could see you down to 100 feet, a silhouette, on a good sunshiny day. And he dropped two bombs, near misses, but
He got rid of his bomb load.
Well, I think the obvious question is, how did he miss you? Weren't you a sitting duck?
Not really. We had probably 100 feet of water above us.
So you were able to submerge a little bit because you saw him coming?
Oh, yeah. No. We submerged immediately. And like I said, when we cleared the conning tower, the radar had him at 10 miles. And then they had to get the lookouts down and the OD down. We went right on down to 100 feet.
So if your buddy, your second class man, hadn't spotted it when he did, you wouldn't have been down 100 feet.
Probably not.
And you might not be here.
Yeah, right.
So that plane's gone, but you don't know when another one's coming?
The captain went out to 50 miles then, and we moved south to a new area anyway. In other words, we didn't lose too much time between the time that we were working on the periscope to the next station, which was right off of Yokohama Bay.
And so, to actually fix it, what did you have to do?
Well, we had to go back Pearl Harbor.
But in the moment, how did you remedy the situation?
We cut out the upper bushing, which was about a 30-inch bronze bushing, which kept that periscope steady when it was raised. And our periscope depth was roughly 60 feet. So from 45 to 60, there were about 15 feet of periscope.
So again, you have to surface, and you guys go up there.
We had to drill little holes. The only equipment we had was what we left with, and that was electric drill and a bunch of drill bits and cold chisels and hammers.
So a little bit at a time.
Yeah, one drill, and we'd get a pocket full of those drills, go down and sharpen them, and then go back up. And this is in the middle of a snowstorm.
You're talking about this like it's no big deal, but you've just been bombed by an airplane. You've got to get this fixed. You don't know if there are other planes coming in or a ship could spot you and fire at you. You're wearing out drill bit after drill bit trying to get a little piece of this off at a time. And it's snowing on you the whole time?
That is correct. That was very miserable as far as weather was concerned.
How long did it take you guys with a little, you know, fraction of an inch at a time to get that done?
2 days and two nights we worked on that periscope. And fortunately, we weren't attacked after that first day.
And did you get any sleep in those 2 days?
Few minutes nap.
What was going through your mind while you're working on that? I mean, because you don't know if you're ever going to get it done or if you're going to finish in time or if you're going to survive this.
We didn't have any choice. It was going to take so long in order to drill two strips of that bushing. We had to take it off in two pieces. And so we had to make two cuts. I was on one side and Cabby was on the other. And we were drilling and chiseling and then spreading, and we had jack screws would help to pull this thing up and spread it out. We had to make those from scratch. We were just fortunate. On the way leaving Portsmouth, we were walking back to the ship, and here was a trash barrel outside the machine shop with a bunch of miscellaneous metal in it. And we just happened to pull out two or three pieces, long pieces, maybe 2 or 3 feet long, of half-inch steel. And that was our jack screws. We had to shred those and use those. Then it was just fortunate that we took it out of that trash barrel before we left Portsmouth.
And again, I don't want to exaggerate here, but it kind of sounds like you were faced with an impossible task that you didn't have the right tools to accomplish.
First of all, you need a crane to get that scope out of the way in the first place.
Which you didn't have.
We didn't have, no. And we didn't have very good weather. We had a lot against us.
It kind of reminds me of that question, how do you eat an elephant? One bite at a time. I mean, you were eating a pretty big elephant there.
That is correct. The hardest way you possibly could do it.
And were there moments Within those couple days, as the snow's falling, your hands are freezing up, you're trying to drill through this thing, that you thought it's not going to happen?
Those are the times when you took the drill bits and went down and sharpened them and maybe grabbed a couple winks of sleep and a cup of coffee or something.
Well, I have to imagine when you finally got it out of there and remedied that problem, that had to feel pretty satisfying.
It did. It did the job, and we were able to complete the patrol run. We sank a good number of ships after that. We got a cruiser, and we got a tanker, and we got a transport out of a convoy. And the cruiser that we got, the torpedo went under the target, got on the other side, and that's where the cruiser was. We got the cruiser, but wasn't really shooting at him in the first place. Anyway, we got three ships. We'd wasted six torpedoes, three one day at a Q-boat and three the next day at another Q-boat. The torpedo depth was set at 3 feet, and they watched it go underneath them. And so that was one of the first clues that we could go back, or the captain could go back to the admiral and say the torpedoes are running deep. Because we were having torpedo problems. Plus, we were trying to shoot it too far away. We fired at roughly 1,000 yards, a half mile. First part of the war, they were figuring they had 2 miles of torpedo run. Well, you might have had 2 miles of torpedo run, but not at the speed you're going.
You know, I'm thinking I should read your citation here. They gave you the Bronze Star, signed by Admiral Nimitz, and the citation says, for meritorious service in action, when his outstanding performance of duty in working 2 days and nights on top of the periscope shears, part of the time in a heavy snowstorm, and under the threat of Japanese air attack, cutting away the upper bearing to allow the lowering of number one periscope, which had bent and jammed in the raised position, aided his commanding officer materially in the sinking of over 28,000 tons and the damaging of 6,000 tons. And maybe it's just me, but I'm thinking the bigger impact there. Yeah, you sank a lot of ton of enemy shipping, but didn't you guys also save the lives of everybody on that boat?
Oh, yes.
That's a pretty big deal.
Well, the third patrol was more dangerous than this first one, but none of them were a picnic, let's put it that way. Every time we sank a ship, we were bound to get at least 25 depth charges. And if there were two destroyers, at one point, we were held down 15 hours and 105 depth charges. You don't sleep doing that. That was on the first patrol run after we got to Yokohama Bay.
Well, that sure seems like a helpless feeling when that's going on. I've got to ask you, though. I'm looking at a picture here of a young sailor with a Bronze Star pinned to his chest and a pretty good look of satisfaction on his face. How did you find out they were giving you the Bronze Star? And what was that like to have an admiral pin it on your uniform?
That's an honor. You feel appreciated.
I guess another question that comes to mind is, how exhausted were you after those 2 days and nights in that snowstorm?
Well, after we got warmed up, we got a good night's sleep. But then we went right on into the Q-boats and then the convoy. And we were forced down at 2 o'clock in the morning in the middle of a battery charge. We surfaced a couple hours later, and we were forced down again with the aerial zeros. Then the sonar reported propellers all around us. We were right in the middle of the convoy. We had 8 torpedoes left and fired all 8, and we got 3 ships.
There seems to be a recurring theme as I listen to some of your stories. You had a lot working against you. Have you ever looked back at everything you did in World War II and say, how in the world did I make it through all of that?
I consider myself very lucky. Like I said, I think I've had a guardian angel looking after me several times in my lifetime.
Hard to argue with that sentiment from Del Schwichtenberg of Carson City, Nevada. Again, you can link to that original interview and more than 500 others at hometownheroesradio.com. And when we come back, a fighter pilot who earned the Navy Cross. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Put $250 in a savings account and you'll start earning dividends. Who else is going to do that for you? And access? So easy. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Again, the website myeecu.org, or just pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a chance to look back at the end of 2018 at just how blessed we've been to meet incredible Americans in different corners of this great country. In Mankato, Minnesota, I had a splendid visit with Lee Nordgren. It's hard to believe in listening back to this interview that the 94-year-old would pass away less than a week after his episode hit the airwaves. He told us what he did to earn the Navy Cross on July 25th, 1945, flying off the aircraft carrier USS Cowpens.
There were 200 airplanes inside this cavern in the sky. Part of them were to protect the task force. The others were to attack as they did the day before. Curry Harbor was like Pearl Harbor was to Americans, and it was well fortified and ready for any action that people would not want to get involved with. So when we broke out of the clouds after flying for about 45 minutes west into Japan, we saw the Issei battleship off to our right, and that was identified when I fired my 50 caliber machine gun for psychological reasons when I was attacking coming down. It recorded it on film, because when we came back from Curry Harbor after attacking, people said, "Where the hell have you been for the last hour and a half?" And we said, "We were at Curry Harbor," and they all said, "Both," until the next day when they saw my film.
All right, so I just want everybody to understand the big picture and the context here. You said Curry Harbor is like Pearl Harbor, and what you meant by that is there's a large concentration of Japanese forces, and it's very well defended. So if you are going to go attack that, you'd probably want to have strength in numbers.
Yeah, you spread out the people firing at you. In fact, after I dropped my bomb on the Issei, I stayed low to the water, figuring that if they aim at me that low, they're going to have to go across the bay and shoot at each other, too, while they're firing. But my flight leader got up there where he should have been shot down right away, and for no reason at all, he got away with it.
Well, and I'm sorry for bouncing around with you, but I don't want to leave out some important details. One of the reasons you were decorated with the Navy Cross for this mission, for this incident, is that you kind of weren't supposed to be there, and nobody else was. It was just two planes out of the 200?
The irony of that is that we had specific orders to jettison our ordnance that was proper to get rid of before you came back to your carrier, because they don't want bombs and rockets flying down the deck on a carrier.
And that was because the weather was bad? They told you to abort and come back and jettison your ordnance?
Yeah, the weather was bad so that they couldn't get out of that stormy cage. There's just no way. And yet my flight leader chose to do that. He wasn't a very good instrument pilot, but I stayed on his wing, and fortunately we got to Curry Harbor and back.
So the rest of those 200 planes obeyed the order and returned, but your flight leader, Dotson, decided we're going to go after some ships?
Yeah, he said, I want to, on a separate channel, he said, I want to hit a target of opportunity at least. We went west and didn't break out at all until we came to Curry Harbor.
And I realize you don't have a whole lot of time to think about it when you're up there in the sky in your Hellcat and your flight leader has made that call. Was there a moment where you said, should I go back or should I follow? And how'd you make that decision?
Well, when you're a wingman, your responsibility is to your flight leader. And so I had no problem with that. I figured that if he'd made a mistake, I'm just sharing the mistake with him. The interesting thing was, after we came back from the attack, our PR people discussed what should be done with it, and they decided that some metal just beyond the air metal, which isn't very high, we should be put in for. And lo and behold, it came back with the Navy Cross. So I think they were being more kind than they should have. We should have been dead.
Well, yeah. So I'm just trying to put myself in your shoes. You're a 20-year-old kid from Minnesota who's out here in the Pacific flying in this horrible weather. Your flight leader decides to ignore a command, go on with the mission, and try to do some damage. And you don't want to let him down as his wingman, but as you started following him toward who knows what, did you think, I don't know if I'm going to get back to the ship at all. This may be it for me.
Well, one of the problems, too, is that I didn't have the equipment operating that permitted me to come back to the carrier task force and know what was the proper area to approach the task force from so that I could be in jeopardy for being shot down by my own airplanes. YEZB, I think, is what they called it. The YEZB. If it was 4 o'clock in the afternoon, you had to come in from 50 degrees. And at another time of the day, you came in at a different angle to the task force. And while it was all general, it still gave them a chance to decide whether they wanted to shoot you down or not.
And a second ago, you made a very blunt and direct statement. You said we should have been dead. Help us understand why that's the case.
Well, when you have a whole bunch of people that are angry at you and they all have guns and they're all shooting at you, the chances are that someone is going to hit you. And the fact is that neither one of us got hit. And that's why they didn't believe us when they checked our airplanes and our airplanes were clean. But when they saw my gun film, they knew that we had been there.
So, and I'm sure this is a day, that July 25th of 45, that you've thought about quite a bit since then and probably replayed in your mind a few times. But if you can, take us from the start to the finish of that attacking run that you and Dotson made on those Japanese forces.
Well, as we broke out of the clouds, I pulled my plotting board out and looked, and I said, we're at Curry Harbor, and that's the EC battleship over there. He said, right, we'll spread out and attack. You take the port side, and I'll take the starboard side. And that's what we did. And I can remember going down, diving down on the carrier, is that when I fired the machine guns, which is not going to do a whole lot to a battleship, it would make some noise, but it also recorded what we did. But it also then pulled my shoulder straps down. And here I'm at probably diving at 60 degrees, and it actually slowed the airplane down. There's 6 50 caliber machine guns in the wings. It slowed me down.
Just the force of them firing?
Just the force of them firing.
So you're firing on your way down, and there's probably some other stuff coming back up at you.
Yeah, oh, I said partway down, I said, Dotson, they're shooting at you. And he said, hell, look behind you. I didn't have an interest in knowing what was back there. It wouldn't help anything anyway.
What's your guess?
Well, if it was like it was behind him, it would be a mess.
Anti-aircraft fire exploding behind you?
Yeah, just anti-aircraft were firing. There were no Japanese planes in the air at that time. None.
Probably a good thing.
Well, yeah, if there'd been some fighters there, we'd have had some additional problems. Then they'd have to cut off firing at us in order for the planes to attack us too. So it gets complicated for them too.
So you make that dive on this battleship and then you drop a bomb or no?
Yeah, we each dropped, we just had 500-pound bombs, but we dropped our bombs on the ship, and we had hydrostatic fuses, which means that they go down into the water a few feet to get below the protection area, and then they explode, so they're a lot more effective that way.
So you dive on the battleship, and then you pull up, and then what?
Well, I didn't pull up. I stayed right down on the water. I thought that if they wanted to shoot at me, they'd also be shooting at each other, people on the ground. But my flight leader pulled up where he really was a prime target and should have been shot. But I caught up with him just before he got back into the clouds. Otherwise, I'd have had the problem of getting back to the task force without getting shot down by our own people.
So what was the result as far as damage inflicted?
I'm not exactly sure. The battleship, the EC, was moored there, so we weren't sure. Supposedly somebody had said it's a foot lower in the water, but I don't know whether that was blarney or not.
So you have to catch up to him to make it safely back to your ship, and then you guys do make it back to the cow pens, and the reaction was?
Well, like I said, with using profanity, then I won't do it again. They didn't believe us until they saw my gun camera film. And that verified the EC battleship, which was the only one that was left. Only EC-style battleship.
What was it like for you to see that gun camera film?
Well, it wasn't a surprise because I had fired it, and gun camera film had been working for me on other targets, so it just confirmed it. But it was in the ready room. They ran it for the other pilots to see, too.
For extraordinary heroism as pilot of a fighter plane in Fighting Squadron 50 attached to the USS Cowpens in action against enemy Japanese forces in the Inland Sea of Japan on July 25, 1945, after all other planes of the task force returned to base because of extremely adverse weather conditions, Lieutenant Junior Grade, then Ensign Nordgren, accompanied his section leader through to the target area, then executing a bombing and strafing attack on a battleship slash carrier in the face of accurate anti-aircraft fire, he inflicted serious damage on the hostile vessel. His gallant fighting spirit and unwavering devotion to duty were in keeping with the highest traditions of the United States Naval Service. What did that mean to you to get the Navy Cross, really in order of prominence, second only to the Medal of Honor, to get the Navy Cross and have those words said about you, a 20-year-old kid from Minnesota? What did that mean to you?
Well, it certainly it made a big thing for the Mankato Free Press, because when I came home, all the different service clubs wanted me to talk about my experience. The circumstances were such that I'm pleased that I could be of service after they're spending the money to train me to do it.
In all the years since then, have you ever thought back on that day and wondered, what was I thinking?
No, not really, because that was my job, just to stay with my flight leader, help protect him against other attack, and maybe even find our way back again if it was necessary, because flight leaders can get confused too.
As you mentioned, you got into combat just months before the war ended, but you did have significant action, obviously, with the Navy Cross. And then you got a taste, up close and personal, of what some of the American prisoners of war had dealt with. How did that unfold? How did you come to see and witness some of those conditions?
Well, we were sent up from Yokosuka Naval Air Station to precede Governor, or now Commander Stassen, to organize and put the 2,000 prisoners of war on a train to come back to Tokyo. They weren't sure whether the people up there knew the war was over or not, so they sent a couple of ensigns up. So I came up with my wingman. And by the way, Honshu, that's the main island with Tokyo on it, is about the size of Minnesota. And flew up to Honshu, and I landed there. And, of course, I don't know any Japanese, and the people there don't know any English. But I took some four-pack cigarettes along. I don't smoke. I have never smoked. But I took them along for conversation. When I put them out, and here's a Japanese fellow, said, "Ah, Chesterfield." So I signaled to have them come over for me. And I'm on the wing of my plane because I had told my wingman to stay in the air until I took my helmet off in case they needed some reminder with firing at a wall or something. Anyway.
Because you weren't sure they knew the war was over?
That's right. Because if they decided, well, what happened then is that he took off running when I signaled I wanted to get the Americans in a ride there. And he came back with an officer with a long, long sword and about eight men with rifles. When he took his sword out, I thought, well, if I try and get my pistol out from behind my life preserver, I'll have four or five holes in me before I can get it out anyway. So I might as well just jump down. And I jumped down, and then he offered me the sword as a piece. And I was stunned, but I accepted it from him. And then after a few moments, I gave it back to him. And the people all cheered. That's when we got the ride from the airport, a grass field, by the way, to the prisoner of war camp. And we got to the prisoner of war camp. There were about 2,000 of them there. We were asked to speak to the group. They put a table out in the middle. And the first question they asked me was, what's going on with baseball? I don't know a bleeping thing about baseball. So Bill Sutherland, my wingman, spoke to him about that. But it almost brought tears to my eyes just looking out at those people. And some of them had been captured in the Philippines and were still alive. My second night there, first night I slept in the cockpit. Second night I slept at because I had a throat infection. I saw more bugs than I'd ever seen in my life. And I thought, wow, just these guys have lived in this for days, weeks, and months, and years. I was very happy then when the doctor said, well, you really shouldn't fly, but if you're going to fly, you better get out there and go. So I flew back down to Yokosuka, and they took me out to the ship. And that's when it was reported that I had received the Navy Cross.
The voice of Lee Nordgren, a lifelong resident of Mankato, Minnesota, who passed away in September just after that interview aired. You can access the whole thing at hometownheroesradio.com. And as we bring 2018 to a close, I know there's so much to look forward to in 2019. In the weeks ahead, we'll hear from an ex-prisoner of war with a story unlike any other I've heard. A man who survived the sinking of his ship and went on to become a prolific restaurateur, founding dozens of chains you've probably heard of. And so many more stories that I'm sure you, the listener, will point me towards as I follow your recommendations. What a privilege it is to bring you this show each week. I'm grateful to all the affiliate radio stations who make that possible, and most of all, thankful for these amazing men and women who united to preserve our country's sovereignty all those years ago and continue to point the way today. Thanks so much for listening to Hometown Heroes today, throughout 2018, and for some of you, all the way back to 2007. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you one more time this year that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.